This is Jan Cox, talk number 523, recorded on July 24th, 1989.
Ready? All right. Opening move. I'll give you the nice, succinct version of what I was going to say. And it goes like this. All systems must name those outside the system in a prejudicial and derogatory fashion. That really says it, but since neural systems have got to be spread around like warm peanut butter to ever start making some other connection, a little more detailed version. Everybody got that version? Is all systems must name those that outside the system in a manner prejudicial and derogatory. The expanded version, a little more detailed version, a little more in focus sketch perhaps, is that healthy, growing, which is the same thing, systems which will, in this case, are mortal systems, which also are synonymous with secondary systems, secondary activities. But all such systems, if they're growing, or if they're healthy, as I said, but now you should know that, if something is healthy, it's growing. Or if it's growing, it's healthy. Have got to name and label systems, entities outside of itself in a fashion that is prejudicial and derogatory. Even further, a faux opposition, but a faux is no faux at all until he is named. Until the essence of his opposition, its opposition, is captured in word. It is not necessary to be sculptured in stone. It is not necessary to be whittled out on the battlefield and within the area of armaments. The first thing, the inescapable thing for a foe to exist, which we've got to have opposition for anything to grow, of course, it has got to be named. Named. Or there is no secondary opposition, is what I'm going to suggest to you. And now I've already jumped the gun and suggested it right off the bat. A system, which includes an individual man, but a system must acknowledge the opposition by name. There can be no such thing for a healthy system, because that would be unhealthy. There cannot be such a thing as some vague, unnamed foe. Why don't you think about it a second? Because nobody on this planet's ever thought about it before. Now, as always, I'm glad to do it, giving you the opportunity to think something that no one else has ever thought before, well, of course, except me. And now you're second and third. It's not like it's a real used-up thought. It's not like you're going with a... It's not like you're going out with a girl who's been waiting on tables at the truck stop there for 17 years. I'm the only one that ever thought it. Life just barely thought it, because I just barely can pick up this information. Enough of you laughed. We will assume here for a second that even without being able to explain it to yourself, that it strikes you and the neural solar plexus that there is some hidden potential value to that information. That opposition must be acknowledged by name. Now, assuming this has, very specific individual potential use, then what might this indicate or implicate, or if we were ordinary, what might this be a premise to? Or if we were better educated, to what might this be a premise? Well, how about this? At the secondary level, at the mortal level, could it be that opposition is actually produced by words? Now, if it be true that opposition must be acknowledged, or the system will begin to wither, it will not be getting the kind of healthy opposition that muscles need from gravity, for instance. But what if you could carry it a little bit further? What if you could get away from linear thinking and ask yourself, could this hint at the fact that opposition is not only necessarily acknowledged by word, that is, it doesn't actually exist until it is named, but what if the naming of something, in this case opposition, what if the naming of it is in some way partially involved with the creation of it? Nah. Don't ever let that kind of information, if it would fly at all, get loose in the halls of academia, like the physics department. That is the naming, because this is really around the spherical corner from what such things as that Heisenberg principle and such as that. This is a little more complex version of that, which I don't, now that I think about it, I don't particularly smell physics being close to that. I don't see what good it would do them in the 3D world right now, but eventually, maybe in our lifetime, somebody is going to come across that kind of idea. Not on this kind of lecture platform, but actually in the little herringbone Tweedy halls of MIT or Caltech or somewhere, and that is that opposition, which is a form, a necessary aspect of energy, as you know, they have their own terms for it, but opposition in the world of physics is necessary, even at the subparticle level, subatomic level, and that opposition doesn't actually exist until it's named. Now, in the clinical areas of physics, I didn't mean to get off on this, but here I am. You do understand that nobody can say, nobody, I don't care what their IQ is and what position they hold and how many Nobel Prizes they have in physics, no one can say, hey, look, I've observed this new phenomena that some of whatever the area they're interested in, that some kind of experiments we've been trying to do, some of the observations other people have made that were inexplicable are now becoming explicable to me because I see there's a kind of other energy, a kind of other action, interaction involved that brings about these kind of anomalous results have been reported. And they say, well, what is it? And he says, well, I call it the XYZ factor. And they go, now what is it? But if he says, well, I don't call it anything yet, even those that might be interested in this man or have some respect for him will go, it's like walking in and you're expecting some kind of information or to meet somebody and they turn around and their face is blank. Just, there's nothing. And they would have to say, well, call it something. And he'd say, well, I don't want to call it anything yet, but it's there. Now, enough of you hear me, but now that it's almost not there. Even outside the area of this kind of specific exotic interest and this kind of activity, even in the world of science, somebody, if he refused, like, I don't call it this for whatever reason, I don't put any name on it until I know more about it. I know it's there. I know it's there. I can prove it's there if you'll trust me. And they go, well, what? Well, I don't want to tell you what it is. I don't even want to put anything. Even if they would go a little bit further, those who might say, all right, I'll stick around, I've trusted you before, show me what it is, to themselves, they'd say something. They probably couldn't resist overtly say, well, look, let's call it the X factor. But what I was saying, that someday somebody's going to stumble on this, by then it won't be of any particular use to people involved with this, whenever it is, but someday in science, in that kind of field, they're going to stumble across not only things must be named, which they would almost buy that now. They wouldn't see any further significance to it. But what I'm trying to point out to you, where I go off on this side path, that opposition does not truly operate. It is not really opposition until it is specifically verbally acknowledged. If that be true, if you get to where you can do those kind of toe spins around a spherical saddle point, then you might ask yourself, well, wait a minute, is the naming itself in some way possibly involved with the actual production of what you're talking about? Because that would be, to the ordinary mind, what shall we call it? Spooky indeed. You mean just by naming it, see, I didn't say caused it or produced it. I'm suggesting the possibility that the naming of it might play, I always like it when I'm reasonable verbally, might play some part, some small part, or some part. Of course, it's the only time I can hear my own voice and it sounds real extremely spooky to be reasonable, conditional. But I would suggest to you that that is, or those two aspects I mentioned could be areas that a person could ask, well, what kind of further hints is this kind of information making? That if opposition, foes, opposition, which has got to be there, you could not talk unless there was opposition, that kind of opposition between your palate and your tongue, between your larynx and the muscles that run vertically and the ones that run horizontally. All of you know this by now, I could not make gestures. The sound waves would not move unless there was opposition. The 3D world would not exist. We would not be conscious. We would not be here, or we would know we were it not for opposition. Not in a negative sense, but there's got to be opposition. Got to be resistance to what's going on, or things won't go on. But now on the secondary level, which is the area of human intelligence, so-called consciousness, what I'm pointing out to you is opposition has got to be acknowledged specifically, and it has got to be named. And as I'm going to try and get you to get a glimpse of, right after it's named, very shortly thereafter, by the kind of time clock that is outside the four dimensions, very shortly thereafter, the naming will be recognized as being prejudicial, derogatory, but in the beginning, at least prejudicial, the opposition. And it can start off being named in a way that may appear to be rather clinical or scientific, that it's a law of nature. This seems to be happening. We don't know what to make of it. But very shortly after that, it will be seen, it will be accepted by other intelligence, including those in the system, that this labeling, this name, this thing itself, maybe we didn't recognize it the split second we realized it was a kind of opposition to what we were doing. But very shortly, it will be seen to be a prejudicial opposition. There is no such thing as a reasonable, a decent, an intelligent, a humane, much less a cooperative, much less a necessary opposition. So the two things I was saying to refresh your consideration that this might be hinting is to ask yourself, could there be any possibility that the opposition itself is in part produced by the naming? The second part that I was going to throw in was, if that had any validity, then would it be possible that the opposition in some way could be attacked, if not overcome, through the same means? Nah. Well, that's too silly to consider, even if you see how simple it is. Yeah, that's too silly. Well, then you could tell something, oh, I even hate to go into this. That's so ridiculous. What if somebody, a system, or something told you, you know what, I've never liked you, and if I get the chance, I'm going to oppose you, or if I ever get a chance, I'll trip you. I don't like you. I'll talk about, I just don't like you. And what if you, in your own dialogue, immediately, if not before, but immediately upon receiving this information, thought, well, that's strange. Now that I think about it, I feel almost exactly the same way about you, and probably more so. You've got to acknowledge the opposition. What if, I just hate to say it, but what if you were silly enough that instead of that, you said, well, that's a shame, but it's not going to bother me because I have always found you to be delightful. And this, now, for whatever reason caused you to do it, I still find it kind of cute. I still like you. Yeah, but what if you didn't mean it? Don't waste my time. What do you mean, what if you didn't mean it? What the hell does that mean? I don't know why you people ask such dumb questions. What if you didn't mean it? Although I did skip over it right fast, was somewhat encouraged. Enough of you gave that laugh of a kind of recognition when I first pointed out, but I am going back for a second. At a very basic, crude human level, that is, of putting words, turning energy into apparent temporary matter, putting clothes on these invisible structures, at a very crude level, do you understand? The powers that be at Kingdom X, State Y, a king, he's got a brother-in-law that takes over the throne of an adjoining kingdom. Then he decides to attack him, whatever happens. And they start working up the propaganda. They start turning up the energy, this particular king, for his people, that we got to attack these other people. At the crudest but most telling level, you do understand that humans cannot get upset, cannot be stirred, unless a so-called foe is labeled, is named. It has got to be identified. The human organism, the human nervous system, will not take it at the secondary level. Now, we're talking about the secondary. We're not talking about the primary level of an individual standing here at the edge of a cliff and a strong wind blows. And non-verbally, you understand, uh-oh, if that wind was just a little stronger, I'd be head over heels, not in love, but in a canyon. But we're talking about secondary opposition, that which appears to be the kinds of civilized foes, intellectual, theoretical, socially, religiously, that is unique, that are unique to man. They cannot stir up any energy, activity in a person, in a group of persons, unless the opposition, unless the potential foe, unless what someone's calling the foe, unless it is identified. Don't let it throw you because it is of extreme interest to those that belong here. The obvious foolishness of it would be, I'll play my part of speaking for ordinary intelligence to say, well, you're just saying that nobody would get upset if they didn't know that someone was potentially an enemy, that they couldn't be upset at the enemy. And I could say, yeah, but keep going. They'd say, well, that doesn't make much sense. But realize the king, the most powerful man, the ruler, the richest, the strongest, got most of the access to most of the facilities of wealth, power, armaments. He calls all the people there, and they come out in the square, and he says, look, we got a problem. They go, okay. We got some people. We got some foes, and we got to get them before they get us. They go, well, all right. He says, well, let's get them. One way or the other, somebody's going to find us, say, well, beg your pardon, my liege, but who? Now, just tell us who. What if he says, no. In some way, he conveys the message that I don't want to tell you, or I can't tell you, or I'm not going to tell you. He does not label them. He just says, anything that you won't fill in here, trust me. Or I mean it, I don't have time, but he will not label them. You cannot get people to accept a blank that is an unnamed entity, that is an unidentified source of energy, You cannot get them involved with that energy until it is named. I'll ask you a third time. What if there is really some useful validity in questioning the fact that, wait a minute, if you never named, if that was an absolute rule, if that was a law, and you in some way could refrain from naming opposition, would that in some way at least adversely affect its creation? Could it even stop it? Now, in the ordinary world, this cannot be allowed to happen. It's too silly, it's too obvious, it's too hidden. This kind of information just simply has no currency to ordinary intelligence. But I assure you that it has quite real five-dimensional, more complex validity in that a system has got to survive, to grow. A system has got to name and label those that it, outside of its system, has got to name them, got to identify them, and it's got to be in a, they can't help it. Nobody plans it, but it comes out in a prejudicial manner, even if they don't start off saying, well, these folks are our enemies. It may not start that way at all. It may start out with, we apparently do not have absolute, imbricate, overlapping fields of interest. Our commercial structure in our state may be slightly different from our neighbors. And our neighbor may be ruled by a king who is my brother-in-law or my brother. So it may not start out on the basis that these groups, these people, these institutions are an individual outside my system, outside my state. They may not immediately be identified as being opposition, as being enemies, but they got to be identified. And very shortly thereafter, for that system, the one that did the identifying, looking at from their view to start with, the label is very shortly, going to be taken by the labeling system as being prejudicial. It's just going to be a matter of just seconds, moments, hours, very shortly. The system that labeled the one outside of itself is very shortly, even if they start out fairly neutral in their identification, it will very shortly start working on them of, you know, I think we've been fooled. At first, I believed that the differences between us and them was fairly innocuous. The kinds of things that could be put aright through diplomatic channels, through reason. But now I don't know. The system is healthy. But notice, if you could get in there, at least on an individual level, and throw sand in those kind of gears, if you could short-circuit that kind of wiring without hurting anybody, that didn't mean anything. You're not going to hurt anybody. If you could do that, then what might that do to your apparent continuing, everybody's apparent continuing opposition from expected and unexpected quarters? And sometimes even half dollars will give you the blues. Another aspect that is not unrelated to this, here's another law for you, for those that like laws. I love little laws. Well, I love the ones that I make up. The rest of them, I don't have a particular feel about Newton and all that stuff. But here's another one for you. All systems are wired up so that they will ultimately begin to think that they are in the rescue business. Take that as a simple declaration of this other law. But now I can expand that a little bit, that all systems are wired up to ultimately begin to believe that they're in the, now I'm going to expand a little bit, in the rescue business, / the conversion trade. Are the forcible education field. Now, I believe that about covers all possibilities verbally. And it goes like this. The system could be, now I know I was using potentially inflammable words of in the conversion business or the rescue trade. And it's got nothing to do with religion, although I guess I'll have to drag it in as an example if I got to point out to you. But let's take something that would seem far removed from those kind of words, a strictly commercial enterprise, a for-profit operation, a system of some kind of business, General Motors, Standard Oil, IBM, all those rotters, AT&T, Wonder Bread, which if you guys don't know it, AT&T owns it now. Which kind of makes you wonder, but but even those systems that apparently, without any doubt, are in the profit business, ultimately will begin to think beyond the profits. I say the profits are already established. The business, the system is flourishing. It's healthy. That system will begin to think that beyond that, it's in a kind of rescue, educational, conversion, doing good. Not at the expense of profits, but we got the business now, the IBM system, the General Motors system, the Ford system, that things now, after some ups and downs and the kind of cyclical rise and fall of the business in general, but there's no danger of Standard Oil going out of business. And so now they began to feel like we should, and then you can fill in, you've heard all the terms, we should give something back to the community. The world is not all the bottom line. And all that sounds fine. They contribute money to PBS, they help sponsor jazz festivals, they help underwrite the Cleveland Symphony, which God knows it needs it. Don't write me from Cleveland. Assuming anybody in Cleveland can, well. Just a joke. It's more than that, though. And it's not any individual. It's not a Lee Iacocca or a Henry Ford IV or V. It's not them sitting around, although some of this happens. I know this. That apparently from individual criticism, and somebody will say, well, these guys, the Ford Foundation just to push their name around. They don't care about doing good. It was for tax benefits at one time. They can sell that kind of crap. That's just part of the general churning up. That's the kind of information that's carried as a subcarrier that I was talking about last time we were taping. But I'm just trying to point in a direction now that you need to start off and see it fairly simply. Just take my kind of crude sketch that I did, that little story about the Taj Mahal. The information, to start with, the sketch does not have to be specific. It does not have to be perfect. I can have flaws built in, but as long as you start out and you got a general impression that you can look and go, oh, that's the Taj Mahal, yeah. You go down here and you take a right, and then you go 200 miles. What I want you to hear is this. It's not that individuals here and there are not accused or might not admit that, yeah, I got my uncle or I got my father to start this offshoot, the Ford Foundation No. 7, I really just wanted my name to go down history. I just need some tax breaks. They may say that doesn't matter. I'm telling you on a more complex scale that life itself is arranged through the activities of man in such a way that systems, the Ford Motor Company and everything involved with it, to isolate it arbitrarily, artificially, and then impossibly, other than verbally, is the only way you can do it, for me to call, all right, here's the Ford Motor Company. It's not that one person is now getting humanitarianly inclined. It's not that one person there wants their name up on a building or the name on stationery, the Henry Ford V Foundation for Good Works and Decency and Ain't I a Great Guy Incorporated. It's not that. I'm telling you that the systems will ultimately begin to believe that they are more. They'll begin to think that they are more than what their original purpose seemed to be. In this case, to make a profit unabashedly, without apology, make a profit. They will eventually not just want to do good, not just, well, let's support the symphony. Or a lot of our employees live in bad parts of town. Let's give them encouragement. We'll lend them money to improve their housing if they will do it themselves, and we'll give it to them at low interest rate. It gets beyond that. It's not identified this way. It takes on the smell of a rescue business. The system, it's not that we just want to help people a little bit and give money to the community. If you can spot it, it's got nothing to do with Ford, it's got nothing to do with any business, it's got nothing to do with any human. It's the way life is arranged. That system will begin to act as though it is in some way partially responsible for helping to redeem, to save mankind. All systems, if they last long enough and healthy enough, they will begin to take on certain aspects of being in the rescue, the conversion business. Not just that we want our employees, to start off with, let's use my example, not just that we want our employees to have better living conditions over in this section of town, close to the plant. It stakes on this. They don't just offer money at low interest rates. They start doing things like they want to send out social workers. They want to start sending out information. They want to start going into their homes and saying, do people go to church? Do you practice birth control? Have all your children had their shots? Well, let us sit down and help you. Is some of the people in the family, some of the parents, perhaps you're illiterate. And you don't know how to go about taking your children for free medical. Let us help. And it all seems well and good. This is no wise an attack on the way life operates, as you know. But it's not recognized that all systems, all the way from a General Motors to a bird watching society, to a motorcycle club, perhaps not Hell's Angels, but like, you know, something a little higher up the evolutionary scale, like accountants on hogs. The guys that get together and they drive around the weekend, they will eventually start doing some kind of good work. They'll eventually start supporting some kind of charity. They'll try to find some disease that nobody's got locked up. And they'll go on rides. The accountants on hogs ride 4,000 miles on the 4th of July weekend to collect money to contribute to Gruber's syndrome. Well, not to contribute to the attempt to stamp out Gruber's syndrome. I certainly hope that they're not supporting Gruber's syndrome. As always, you people getting this on tape at other times and other places, I will point out, this really has nothing specifically to do with ordinary life, with the Ford Foundation, with charitable activities, with Lee Iacocca, with Herman Greenstrom, if you remember him, Arnold Ziffel, Thomas Jefferson, Karl Marx, Frederick Engels, Smith and Wesson. I am simply using the kinds of activities that are right before your very eyes that life is continually talking about piecemeal, that life makes visible within a certain limited area of the electromagnetic spectrum to where you think you see things. You think, well, I saw it in person, so I know what happened. You know what you could see. You knew what you could hear. I'm using those, but this has something to do with that which is beyond matter. Just a version of it. It's not any more spooky. But this apparently is matter. Once you put words on it, that apparently I was talking about the charitable activities of large businesses. It's a matter of the conversion, the distribution of energy within life itself, of which man plays a very cogent and important part, such as the hole in the finger at the end of a little finger, if you remember a rubber glove. And those people that didn't see the last tape, figure it out. Of course, just that by itself kind of doesn't make man sound all that important, does it? But go back and see another tape if you'd like to. Something else about systems. Move away from charity into something equally as interesting. How about music? To you right quick. All systems have a hook. For those of you who don't keep up with music, a hook is referred to, it came about in popular music to my knowledge, but a hook is that which seems to hook into your mind, you know, like those of you old enough, like Rolling Stone Satisfaction, you know, da 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 da. No matter what else you know, if you hear anything about music, you remember that. Or if they had been using it, Beethoven. Now, if we could jump back, if they had such a term back in the early 19th century, you know, the hook of Beethoven's Fifth, you know, da 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 da. That's the hook. All systems, even if you don't know anything about music, you never heard it before, all systems have a hook. Religions, political movements, social theories, attempted reform movements, all have a hook. Now, the hook may not get you because everybody didn't like Satisfaction by the Rolling Stones, for instance. I picked it out. I was trying to think of something that cut across most of you people's lifespan. Enough people liked it that it sold in the millions. And it's now a golden, moldy oldie. But besides the words, those that really that would say, yeah, I really like that. If you had any sense of music, just by saying, if I said, Satisfaction, somewhere in your dialogue, many of you already went, dun, 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 dun. It's the hook. It's that which seems to be in the music biz, where they can't, with it. Right or wrong, in the biz, they consider that every hit record has a hook. Of course, anybody that says that is supposed to have the musical wherewithal that if you challenge them, they go, well, all right, it's that part. You hear where the guitar just goes, no. Just keep even saying what they're doing, they'll say, well, there's something in there. It's not the words. It's not that this is poetry at the level that's going to rival the Greeks or Robert Browning. But that the song has a hook to it. All systems, and they're all, we're still talking about secondary system, we're talking about mortal activities, all of them have got a hook. There is something, it may not got you. You may not have cared for Satisfaction. You may not care for Christianity. Christianity has a hook, but it may not get you. And you can say, well, I'm not Christian, I am a Buddhist by choice. Then if you don't know, well, all of you would have to be by choice. I don't see a natural-born Buddhist here. It has a hook to it. There is something in there. And there is a hook. There is a hook in all continuing ideas in your own brain. The things, no matter what you might try to say, if you were to attempt to analyze this, that if you said, well, there is things in my head that approach the concept of the E.D. Feeks, but I think I know why. Or conversely, the same thing, you could say, yes, I do. There are some constant thoughts, some ideas, some fears, some dreams I've had all my life, it seems. And this is the same thing as the first example I gave, the first attempted explanation, that no, I don't know what caused them, but it's obvious since I don't know what caused them, subconscious motivations. Same thing. In other words, the 3D world to say I know what something is, or to say I don't know why it is, it's the same thing. You're getting that good, aren't you? It's the same thing. It doesn't matter. People cannot explain. They can attempt. But if you could measure energy satisfaction, you should know by now, you cannot explain your life. Not up to the point of where the nervous system has been activated in you already. Not up to line-level consciousness. Not up to old-world intelligence and all the many things I've called it. Up to where your nervous system is running and healthy. Up to that point. Everything down below that, everything up until now, if you had any ability to be correct, or as they call it in the city in their foolish way, in their cute way, in their little cute chubby way, they call it the truth. if you could tell the truth, you would say, I've done a lot of things. I've done some of this, I've done some of that. I don't know why I did any of it. Oh, I could lie to you, as they like to call it. I could lie to you and say, yeah, I know why I did this. Maybe I shouldn't have done it, and if I had to do it, or maybe I wouldn't do it. But yeah, I've got some idea what motivated me. Am I right? Huh? Am I right? He says, when you're right, you're right. Which is the only reason I ever have an assistant. He, in fact, goes past the concept of a yes man. He's a correct man. But an ordinary person, I could play somebody. Or I could just probably trick somebody or just attract somebody that would say yes, 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 and be a yes man. But we're not in Hollywood. We're here in Georgia. We're in a different world. You don't need a yes man. When they're really good, what they're doing is affirming you're not just yes, you're not just true, you are correct. That's my man. People could not explain why they have these ideas. I'm telling you that all ideas that you have had constantly, these handful of ideas, these dreams, these fears, they have a hook as surely as, if you like music, that you can hear that same little riff of Satisfaction, or you can hear a certain riff out of JB doing Cold Sweat, or you can hear the first four notes of Bach, of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, or that you can hear the opening lines of Eine kleine Nachtmusik. There is a hook, and it makes you keep doing this the same way that I'm sure most of you have been through this, that sometimes you thought, Jesus, I'm driving myself crazy whistling that brand new lovely Guns N' Roses song off their new album. I just keep whistling, and not the whole song. It's just that one half measures, those first five notes. All day long, I keep going, no, 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 no. You see, people take that as being at least a slight anomaly while ignoring that I keep thinking the same thing, not musically, but I keep thinking the same thing over and over and over and over, and I don't notice it because I think it's me talking. I think it's me thinking. I think it's me attempting to be original. You're singing a song, like whenever Satisfaction came out from the late 60s, from 1969, 20 years, you've been singing that same riff over and over and over and over. But as far as thinking that you are what you are, it's taking that dialogue with its irresistible hook. The dialogue inside of you, you have been whistling that hook over and over, not just for 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, and we won't go any further and embarrass any of you. But you have been doing it because all systems, including man, including that which runs man, including that which furnishes the system, the energy for man, the system, they all have hooks. And they are all as captious, deviously, and devilishly clever as Jagger and Richard came up with, or good old Beethoven. The hooks are there. All systems have them. Could have tried to pass him off with one of the wild Chapatulas. Speaking about music, I'll give you another law. People are generally wired up, which is really the terms that everyone should be using, including me, since it's my term. Instead of people are want to, or people normally, or I suggest that people are, is people are generally wired up to, in this case, do the following. To want to think improvisationally. They want to think in a sense of being a work in progress. Or to go back to music. They want to think, generally, somewhat like Ornette Coleman. Just freedom. I just want to think. But they then want to act because of the way they're wired up. They want to act more like they had a score, a chart, a predictable piece of music. So that their life is more like the Boston Pops. Well, at least I didn't say Lawrence Welk. If you'll think about it a second, beyond the humor, and beyond, since I was already talking about music, for me to apparently pull this out and tie it in, it is a fact. Not everybody, by any means, but generally, I'm just speaking about the general bell curve of humanity, especially in this part of the world, I might add that, but generally, people are generally wired up, those who have a very active intellectual language going on. Just modern, contemporary, Western man. They're generally wired up, without knowing it in this way, that they want to think improvisationally. They don't have to know the term. You don't have to have any musical ability. But it is kind of a free-floating thinking. People talk about it. Ordinary people. But the same people, the same heart of that bell curve is wired up in such a way that generally people do not want to act in that way. Contrary. Even faced with what seems to be circumstances that might encourage or almost force that kind of behavior, frightens people to the point that sometimes naughty things happen. It's frightening to people. People are not wired up to want to act in a kind of improvisational way. The systems in which man lives, all the way from his internal molecular system to what would apparently be external systems of social norms, etiquette, is all a matter of predictability that each tribe, each culture, each nation, each little state seems to have a kind of written, unwritten combinations thereof, expectations that there is seems to be a general score of everyone who lives around the Massachusetts area. Everybody seems to have this kind of score that came from the Boston Pops, that you generally know how people in your area will behave. Then you know, generally speaking, how you are going to have to behave. Internally, you might say, well, some of the things I don't agree with in life. I don't like him to dress up to get into some of these restaurants. I don't like him to dress up to go out to see the symphony. I don't like him to wear a tie. Why do you have to wear a tie? What if I just showed up now or even wore my tuxedo and I didn't wear a tie? Ha, ha, ha. A man can say that, but you know the man's going to show up with his tie on. There is a kind of safety. There is a kind of predictability by living closer to having a score. Score, I'm using the musical sense, that the music is written out. When Lawrence Welk plays a song, he can say, we're going to do a song here that Ornette Coleman made kind of popular 20 years ago, and here's our version. His version is, every note you hear from every instrument is written down. Lawrence don't tolerate a man staying up and says, I'll take a chorus. No. The man gonna take a trip. He gonna be gone. People are not wired up to want to live. Remember, the two things that are possible for humans along one line that is unique, that they can not only act, which they have in common with other creatures in the three-dimensional world, but they can think about acting. They can think about acting in a sense as a substitute for acting, as a prelude to acting. They can think about acting after they have acted. They can do combinations. They can think about acting while doing the acting. They can be doing some acting, think about other acting. Witness the fact that so many women will go to bed with men, which work on that in your own time. Just, I periodically thought if anybody should ever praise imagination, I always assumed it was women. Because that's just a man's view, but I'm sure some of you men, you turn around and look at men and think, Jesus. How can women do this? Well, I got no personal interest in that. I just... things I've heard about. Life is wired in such a way. Now, let's get away from the apparent close and me temporarily turning these kinds of nonverbal, unrecognized energies into verbally recognizable matter temporarily. This specifically has to do with it being a kind of reflection of the necessary balance between C, D, and E energies as manifested through the intellect of man. Phew, all right. So be it, all right, okay. That's why they made up the terms, evidently. That I was so glad somebody sent them to me from Southern California in a package. Of, okay, all right, okay. Andy. Well, somebody sent me a variation of that to go along with, okay, all right, okay. Let's try it this way then. I will assume, for the sake of assuming, that some of you thought you smelled, heard, saw something when I said that, generally speaking, contemporary, educated, intellectual men are wired up, without knowing the term, without thinking about it in a way, that they want to think improvisationally. That is, they want a kind of freedom. They talk about it. I want the freedom to believe anything or to think what I want to. I don't want some kind of mind patrol looking over my shoulder, trying to investigate if they had a machine. I want to be able to think whatever I want to. But even if I smile at somebody, I want the privilege internally to think, fuck you. You know, that sort of thing. Or to see a cop and smile and say, have a nice day, and internally get shot. People say that. People would say that in a sense to themselves that that's the kind of freedom he was pointing out to them that I believe in. But it is a kind of desire that is wired up and is not for some individual benefit. It has to do with that which, from the three-dimensional level, me going back to using my temporary descriptions, my ad hoc verbalizations, and close on the three absolute necessary forces to make things operate in the three- and four-dimensional world, the visible world, the ones I'd call C, D, and E, in which ordinarily in any particular circumstance, the ordinary intelligence sees that apparently there's some kind of good force going on, creative force, decent force, constructive force, creative force, and then there's always some kind of Philistine-based opposition, evilness, stupidity, clumsiness, coarseness. Everybody knows that. And then I say, all right, there's another one. And to make it short, they might say, well, what is it? And I say, well, it's everything that you didn't enumerate. And they say, okay, you know, you can have that. That's E, all right? We all remember that, right? Okay, okay. What I'm pointing out, that I started out with a fairly direct law of saying that people are wired up generally to want to think improvisationally, like a work in progress, an ongoing affair. But they are likewise wired up that they want to live, that is, they want to act, not think about acting, but when it's actually forced to act, they want to act in a way that seems closer to a known, predictable score, charts. So that you know what to play, you know what to say, you know what to move, you know which fork to take, you know who to bow to, you know who to snub. As you know your place in this music, this piece of music, in this orchestra. The reality of it, more of the reality behind those kind of verbal known shadows, is that this is a manifestation of a necessary balance inside the body of life between the C, D, and E forces, between the three forces, as it gets manifested in man. Okay, all right. Went through it again and didn't do much, right? I'll leave you with this then for that paragraph. And under any conditions, you fill it in that you thought you were observing in life. Don't try to think it's a death and use necessarily my maps right for a second, but just what would appear to be those kinds of good forces in life. Those that just ordinarily would seem to be systems with attitudes and behaviors, goals, information that seem to be for the general welfare of people, to do good, creative. Do they not have the tinge of being kind of freeform, that there is some looseness involved? It's not necessarily called that. It might be called they are more humane. They're more civilized. They are not in some kind of intellectual lockstep. You do not find that which by any general middle class, middle of the bell curve, conception of a system, you do not find it being identified by the general populace as being in any way creative and simultaneously be thought of as being some kind of fascist, some kind of real conservative. Art museums, new works of music are not written, if I got to make it real quick, they're not written by overweight guys from Alabama in a polyester double knit leisure suit who are racist, protectionist, believe in international banking conspiracies. You do know, don't you, when I say that? I'm just putting again, that's not the reason. It's not people in Alabama or Mississippi or southern New Jersey that are holding back the creative juices of this planet. But once I try to make it crude, you do realize that those kinds of people, which serve their own purpose and they're as necessary as you are, they do not open art galleries in Soho. They do not commission. They do not go to their city council and say, let's raise the taxes and commission some guy from New York to come in here and write a piece of real weird music for our little symphony to play. Or conversely, they do not end up writing poetry. Unless it's something about how much I hate my fellow man on the bathroom wall. They do not play a part from the visible middle class observation point. They do not play a part in what would seem to be the C force, right? Does that give you any more of a hint? That there, I'm suggesting that there is a direct connection between the necessary balance in life's healthy growth, between what would appear to be C forces, constructive, good, constructive forces, and that which appears to always be its opposition, D, destructive. Conservative, reactionary, and then the E force. Everything else that seems to be for the time being, at least vis-a-vis this situation, all those other forces, all those other possibilities that seem to be irrelevant. That I am suggesting that there is a direct correlation between that and the fact that people are generally wired up to want to think in a way that more resembles improvisation than it is the way that they're wired up, the same people, to want to act, which is in a more predictable, chartered, scored, written out fashion. All right, I'll try one more before I lay this paragraph. Part of the necessary flow of energy, part of the juices that are necessary for life to continue to grow, particularly through man, is that at one point, in one area of where the creative goo is coming out the hole in the little finger of the rubber glove, man's intelligence, in one way there has to be a direct, a quite real feel in thinking of, hey, in certain respects, all of this is kind of improvisational. Nobody really knows what's going on. You try to do something new or good, you know, who knows? A lot of it, good art's an accident. Simultaneously, there has to be even an artist, a wild man, if not an Ornette Coleman, he's too old, who's a wild man now? Barrence Whitfield, Hazel Atkins, some guy on a street corner, Mad Dog McGillicuddy with a guitar made out of a blown Michelin tire and a part of an old four-slice toaster, and he's turned into some kind of instrument, and he's out on a street corner wrapped in rags, And he's writing music on the spot, you know, screaming things like, I hate the world and I hate me and get away from me. You got 3 feet. Yeah, you. That kind of thing. Of course, normally when it goes that far, they're outside the middle class. They're outside the general bell curve of the way of humanity. But what I'm trying to get you to see is people are not attracted to that. People, it's as though life wants a part of the continuing process of life to have this kind of feel, and if you can do it right, thought, that part of this is improvisational. Part of this is kind of unpredictable. But part of it has got to be very predictable. Part of it has got to be quite down-home, middle class. It is like a combination. There was such a thing of Lawrence Welk back in business, and he's featuring in his sections. He's got Ornette. He's got Ronald Shannon Jackson. He's got Blood Ulmer. It's that kind of combination. Plus, it'd have to be the E. There'd have to be a whole bunch of people around that there the band is playing, and he's got these wild men up there inside his band. And then you'd need the E forces around, the people around that do not like, do not dislike Lawrence Welk, do not like, do not dislike Ornette Coleman and free jazz, do not like or dislike them put together, that the band is really, if you want to call it, wailing, doing whatever they're doing, and you go up to this group, and you say, what do you think of that band? They go, oh, I didn't know this was a band there. No, they're about to blow the house down. You got to have all three. Now, and now I'm going to leave it, but now, the end of the paragraph, in you, in one person's brain. How much time we got? All right, let me tell you something else. Life speaks in sentence fragments. This old prevailing idea, I'll bring up again, that there have been all sorts of people, weird and non-weird, all sorts of fairly generally wired up people have had the thought that there's some kind of information around that may be secret. And they don't have to be metaphysical fruit flies in the brain. Just it strikes fairly ordinary people at times that, you know, I bet there's more to life than we imagine. I wonder what's on TV. They don't necessarily believe that they're old, hidden 2,000-year-old men in caves in Tibet and all that, but they have a feeling that, you know, there's more to life than may be readily observable. There may be more to life than we've actually thought about thus far. There may be laws that we don't know about. There may be people superior to us just outside our solar system, and they're on the way here as fast as they can. They got the pedal to the metal. Honey, we're getting popcorn. It happens to fairly ordinary people. But I was going to head and put it again into an absolute, for the time being, an absolute ad hoc law that life at this level, if you want a little more specific, life speaks in sentence fragments. That is the basis of people's nervous system, of people's brain believing, you know, sometimes I believe, honey, that I almost am about to have a great thought of some kind. Or sometimes I almost think that I've got life figured out. I just feel like that it's almost like a puzzle I've been playing with all my life, and I read, and I ponder, and I think, and I listen to other opinions. And it's like sometimes that, like you got a puzzle, a jigsaw, and it's all, it's just about right. And there's a piece missing. Or the one that's left here, I'm just sure it won't fit. I don't even won't pick it up. I can look at it. It's like something is always just out of reach. I am trying to suggest you a potentially more profitable way through this unknown, made up, spur of the moment, off the cuff, ad hoc, useful only by its usage, defined only by its usage, law, colon, quotation marks. Life speaks in fragments, into quotation marks. if you can begin to see it and hear it in that way, it's not that things are hidden. It's not that you're being deluded. It's not that the gods, according to the Western and, well, Eastern Mediterranean tradition, good old story of the Tower of Babel, that the gods got mad and made people talk in such diverse tongues, which doesn't require that somebody be speaking in Yiddish and somebody else in Turkish. They don't think alike. And thus you have the situation of Babel, that there is no direct communication, that people don't really understand each other. Thus, people do not really understand what life is saying, if indeed life is talking. It's not a matter of a different language. It's not a matter of hidden language. It's a matter that what you are hearing, what everyone is hearing, is fragments. And there's nothing wrong with what you do hear. There's nothing incorrect. There's nothing invalid. There's nothing willfully distracting, disrupting over that which is ordinarily heard. But it is not ordinarily recognized that what you are hearing in the visible world, what you are hearing are fragments, always. Trust me for the night. That is a workable law. Further, we'll take that as a, God forbid, premise. Don't take it as a premise. I just said that because I had to say something. Take that as a premise. That's right, a law is not a premise, not if it's a real law. To be able to hear that which is missing, because the rest of the sentence is there, it's somewhere. When I said life speaks in fragments, that is what is available to be heard. Life does not speak in fragments. In the visible world, it is though life speaks in fragments. The rest of the sound, the rest of the information is around. It can, you can increase what you hear life saying. One of the ways. You have got to listen in a non-personal fashion. There is no escape from it. And it is the way that the human nervous system is wired up makes it almost, I'll agree, almost. Am I right or not? He said, yes, almost impossible not to think about anything in a non-personal manner. Why else would you be interested in it, et cetera, et cetera? But it amounts to this. Try not to let it throw you again, whether it's either too obvious or too spooky or too even obtuse. If you were listening to life talk, of course, you would think ordinarily that you were listening to a debate. You're listening to legislators. You're listening to social commentators. But you're listening to life, and it's discussing potential changes in our laws governing the sale and consumption of alcohol. You cannot hear anything new if you listen to the discussion over alcohol laws with your ears tied to your own drinking habits. It's impossible. And don't take that. Is either too obvious or too non-obvious. Ordinarily, it is not perceived. I could take somebody ordinary, could I not? Not you necessarily. And I could talk. And I could talk in a manner that seemed to be directly psychologically based and not inferring that I'm anything else. And I could get ordinary people to say, well, yeah, once you put it that way, that's true. That you're just saying everybody's thought processes. Well, not everybody's. Remember, I'm speaking now for ordinary intelligence. Who would say, well, you're right. In many instances, you could come up with instances where what people think about something is absolutely prejudicial based upon their own desires, their own inclinations, their own habits. It's what you mean. I guess, oh, yeah, I mean that. But God Almighty, I mean more than that. Because they would not even benefit from that. It'd be forgotten as soon as it was said. But notice, if you want to take what appears to be an external example, you can turn on, watch a talk show or listen to talk radio or interviews with presidents, prime ministers, religious leaders, psychiatrists, famous authors, and the subject will come up. And if all you got to do is listen. And you may have thought that the person up to that point, you might have thought, well, I'd like to remember his or her name. If he wrote a book or something, that's the kind of intellectual stimulation I like. Now, that person, they may not be anything exceptional, but at least they've got the kind of intellectual activity going on, the way they talk and the way they think, that's inspiring. It would be good fodder for me to read. And you don't listen to it. They'll be talking about some subject, and the commentator running the discussion. You may say, well, you know, there's an interesting thing, all the talk about drugs going to destroy the fabric of American society, or the world in general, and we still overlook that alcohol is a very strong drug. And so one of the commentators, one of the people there on this panel, began to say, well, yes, that's very interesting. We do ignore that. And although alcohol has had its uses even under religious guises, and it's been used in ways that seem to have some spiritual use, and even though it's as old as recorded history, and even though it does seem to have certain, and they sound as though, and the person may be a doctor even, and they may go into apparent almost clinical descriptions and some pros and cons of alcohol, but then if you listen, if the person is really interested, which they'd have to be, or they wouldn't have talked as far as I've talked, if you can finally hear beyond the sentence fragments what they're going to start talking about, the only reason they're interested is based on, is tied to their own drinking habits. And that could include not drinking. The point is, they have a hardwired, inescapable, vested interest. Not a human interest, not an individual interest, not a psychological interest. It's life's interest. And they listen to everything in a personal way. And if you do, all you'll hear are fragments. Because there's more information there. But now let me change it. Instead of me saying, all you hear is sentence fragments, that's all life is, all you've got is fragmentary audio capacities. Because as long, which is, just want to say you're ordinary, but as long as everything you listen to that interests you, and you say, well, wait a minute, I've got some comments. I've had some thoughts about how they should handle the distribution, the control of alcoholic substances in the world. I know what would be better for civilization. Do you hear me? I don't care who it is. It could be Einstein. It could be Dr. Joyce Brothers. An interesting juxtaposition. Someone apparently saying, well, and they start giving a history of alcohol. They start giving a psychological commentary, apparently, of the sociological ramifications, failures, and successes of the attempted prohibition in the United States of America. And they talk about all this, but if you begin to hear more, the person, if they're interested in this question or any question, they're not talking in some clinical, objective fashion about the history, the pros and cons of the more stringent control of alcohol sale and distribution. They're talking about their interest in drinking. They're talking about their interest. Once you begin to hear it, it's cute. It's cute. A TV evangelist, the Pope, the rabbi of the year, the philosopher of the year that stands up and begins to convey observations, sermons, appeals to reform, let me rescue you, let me educate you. And they point out things that may produce in you apparent guilt or in other people, like, you people shouldn't be doing so-and-so. The gods don't want you to do so-and-so. The forces, the good forces in the universe don't want you to do so-and-so. And you may hear that, and you may dance with it. You may be wired in such a way that you go, oh, yes, that's true. Good God. If you could hear beyond, it's a fragment you're hearing. Because if you heard any more, the Pope, a religious leader of any kind, is not denouncing sin. He's talking about his own sinful habits. And I'm just using sin in their words. means nothing. They are describing that, yes, I'm at the center of this. Listen, I am tied up. I've been dancing with this. I still dance with it. Except all you hear are fragments. That somebody apparently in some position, some authority, some credentials. They say, I'm here to deliver to you. I've worked on this a long time. I've had years of experience. I want to give you a short history, some of the pros and cons, and some perhaps objective suggestions, some ideas you could carry with you concerning the role, pro and con, of alcohol in society today. And the person shuffles their papers, and you're going to hear fragments. They can't help it. You're going to hear a personal flow of energy. That is, you're going to hear personal commentaries, but when you hear fragments, you can take it another way. You're supposed to. Well, this is instructional. I don't know. Can you hold it a second until I get my pen and pencil? I want to take notes. It's not going to be instructional unless you need to know something about the guy. And you already know something about him if his subject is the place of alcohol in our society. Well, I already know a lot about the guy if that's his subject. Now, I don't care what the guy says, if he's for it, against it, if he's a minister, a rabbi, an atheist. I don't care who he is. I've already heard more than he heard. I know more about him and his relationship to alcohol than he does. Why? I don't have a secret book. If you can get past hearing the fragments, it's like you got a radio tuned in and you just kept picking up little pieces. It fades out. But everybody picks up enough that they believe they know what's going on. Well, until they're asked, you know what's going on, everybody goes... But it's as though all this makes sense. You're used to it. You listen in fragments. You think in fragments. The information that life makes easily available is sentence fragments. But the rest of the information is there. But if your tuning mechanism is the frequency at which you operate your little crystal, that you pick up what you hear. And I'm just using hear, it's sensual, all of it. But what you hear, if you only hear it through your personal ears, you only hear it on that one frequency. Or the limited frequency of you being in the center of it all. That's all personal. You don't have any interest in it, which it can't be otherwise, can it? Then what you hear are always fragments. You don't hear the full transmission. It's impossible. It's like that they are broadcasting, let's say, on the FM band from whatever it is, 89 up to 1600 or whatever it is, 1010, that through this full FM spectrum comes live talking. Your ears are only tuned to 104.89. It's got to be an odd number, doesn't it? 104.9. So, you're always picking up a piece of it. And picking up enough that life makes enough sense to get you by without going nuts. But what it amounts to use those kind of temporary but sometimes useful beginning verbal dress that sounds psychological, as long as you're listening personally, and you've got to realize that anything that seems to interest you, you've got some personal interest in it. And then, of course, a good explorer realizes, I don't have a personal interest in this crap. I mean, I do. My dialogue does. As long as I've been here in me, this thing's been going on about whatever it is, alcohol, religion, sex, my nose and sex. I don't know. That this has been going on, but it's not my personal interest. So you can have, as if you had a choice, whatever one else has, a personal interest in everything you have a personal interest in. It can't be otherwise. But then to find out that, hey, my personal interest, they could take a walk. Once you find out that, I can take my personal interest and turn my back on them. I can tell my personal interest, hey, you guys have been great, and I know you're serious. And as always, I know you're trying to help, but hey, don't bother, all right? You can do that and find out. The easy version is, do that and find out nothing in you, no part of your life is harmed. First version. Second version is, if you really pursue this for a little bit, nothing is harmed, things are a lot better. Then ordinary intelligence could respond to that and say, how could things be better? How could a man live and not have a personal interest in stuff? That's just shocking to hear about it, even if it's true. Shocking your knickers. How could a man have any interest if they weren't personal? Well, why are any of you people interested in this? What's the personal benefit as you first perceived it of this? All right, I'll withdraw that question. If that's the way you feel. But it would sound to be impossible to realize that the only thing you have any personal interest in, you've got a personal interest in. You got to realize that. I don't care how it comes out. I don't care how the dialogue talks to you that, well, I have a drink now and then, but I don't have any drinking problem. That's not it. But I do have some concern. I know some people do. And I know that there's too many accidents going on, and I know that our health care industry is being overloaded now with the ramifications, the effects of excessive drinking in our society. I know that. It's not my problem. But I think we should all, I mean, there are things I can't change the whole world, perhaps. But there's some legislation pending in our state legislature now that wants to raise the drinking age back up to 21 from 18. I don't have any children. Well, my children, I have some, but they're over 21, and they don't have any drinking problem any more than I do. But I just feel like it's something I should give back to the community. Help my fellow man. Help rescue other systems, people outside of me. So, I mean, it's nothing to me. I don't care. I can drink or I can not drink. But they're going to have a rally down in front of the Capitol today, and I thought maybe I might go down and at least show that they got my moral support, because sooner or later, you got to take a stand for what's right. All that sounds good. All of that is the way life has got to work. But do you understand that a person wired up to say that, to think that, has drinking habits, even if they don't drink? They got a personal interest in alcohol. Or they would not have an interest in stamping it out, controlling it. They simply wouldn't have an interest. It'd be like, that they heard there's going to be a rally down at the Capitol today, that they want to make post offices give you a discount when you buy over $100 worth of commemorative stamps. Let's assume that you're not a polygynist or whatever the hell they are. Let's assume that you don't have any interest in stamp collection. And you got on the news. You're sitting there in front of your TV watching the news, and they're talking about stuff, raiding a topless joint, you know, showing film, showing real important news that you need to keep up with. Then they go from showing the half-nude girls trying to hide in the paddy wagon, they go from that to them saying, also, there was a rally in the front of the Capitol today of stamp collectors, and you hear them saying that they want the U.S. Postal Service to get some kind of discount when an individual buys more than $200 for the commemorative stamp. You sit there, and the sound waves go in your ear, you see the flashing on the cathode. But it's just nothing to you, right? Because you do not have a personal interest in it. Then, ordinary intelligence would say to me, this kind of thing, it would say, wait a minute. All right, all of that has some validity. I don't see the purpose of it. All you're saying is just a self-affirming given that nobody has a personal interest in anything unless they got a personal interest in it. So what's the point of what you're saying? If the point is that you could be otherwise, that's shocking. I mean, it sounds dangerous. It sounds like you'd be less than human to say that you got interest in things that you got no interest in. I didn't say that. Well, we're out of tape. That's the end of the public tape. And I would like to thank you for joining us tonight out there, but I won't. Oh. Is it back all running? Do the back on. This is a, you can say this is a public epilogue. Anybody that's there can watch it. You understood what I meant by that. From now on, you folks in other cities will consider their public and private epilogues. I'm trying to end the tapes because people are beginning to, some of the groups are trying to use these and put them on cable TV and to save some of the editing. Anything I have to say specifically that it is tied to a clock, that is, it's only pertinent to you people watching the tape and at some particular time, will always be an epilogue, and we'll announce somewhere, Cindy will put in a note. If it says a private epilogue, it's just you people that are, consider yourself the groups in the other cities. And if there are people just coming by that's been here a few times and still kind of attend these, let them leave. If the note says it's public, then I don't care. Anybody that's there that saw the rest of the tape can see this. You know what I mean? Huh? It was a little excursion for you and your new people. It's like a little thing to do if you want to do it. Consider, just look around. For the next 117 hours, after that, don't do it now. I don't want you to hurt yourself. But look around. Look around and see what hooks you can spot inside of all systems. Advertising, the sale from a particular, the push from a particular company. Ford, just to get it, right now, I think they're still going on. They've been using the slogan, and they must believe it's had some effect. Quality is job number one. Of course, some of you know, all of you suspect, that the nexus between advertising and services and products are about as ephemeral as my goodwill. I mean, my interest in your interest in strangers. Christianity, the hook is Jesus saves. All you got to do is say, okay, I need to be rescued. I need to be helped, and I'm all yours. That's the hook. Short and sweet. Just look around. They're everywhere. AT&T, a politician, they look for it. They don't always call it by any means a hook, but all systems that are flourishing out there in the marketplace, commercially, educationally, socially, charitably, everybody, all systems got a hook. Just look around. You just never thought about it. Of course, if you really try to get good, is just don't look at the ones that you're naturally attracted to, because then you're just taking it all personally again. But look around at things that doesn't interest you. Some religion, some social movement, historically or contemporaneously. But if you'll look, it's right there in front of you. It has a hook that those who are interested in it are going around going da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da over and over and over. Jesus saved, Jesus saved, Jesus saved. Some of you, I bet, will have some fun with it, and you'll be surprised that I didn't really want to hint anymore, but it's all the way from business, politics, down to just everyday social interaction between peoples that is in some kind of habitual state to where it's become systematized between you and some group of people around the water fountain at work, between you and parts of your family. It has a hook. Do, 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 do.
That concludes this talk. Be sure to visit us at jancox.com, where you can search through 3,000 talks for topics of interest, or just leave us a message.